Hello and welcome to this week's PropCast in association with Property Week. I'm Andrew Teacher, Senior Advisor to Montford, and I'm joined this week by Hugh Seaborn, who's the Chief Executive at Cadogan. We're going to be talking a lot about placemaking, about social value, about community investment, and about some of the amazing things that are happening around Chelsea, not least the amazing new mixed-use development, the Gaumont, which is going to be coming to the market over the next year. Hugh Seaborn, lovely to see you. Thank you very much for making the time. Now, you've had a lot on your plate over the last years, like everybody in real estate, but there's been a tremendous amount of stuff happening in Chelsea. What are some of the things that are keeping you most busy as we enter 2024?
Well, hello, Andrew. It's great to see you again, too. It's difficult to choose what's keeping us most busy because there's so much going on at the moment. And we're really thriving. We're still talking about the recovery from the pandemic, but actually it's fair enough because it's just slightly less than 2 years that the last restrictions came off trading. But our recovery from that pandemic was very strong and very rapid, and that's been maintained since. So we're seeing strong demand for shops on King's Road. Good shops, see four or five offers each shop. And then on Sloane Street, particularly the North End, where the super luxury global retailers are, we have a lot of inquiries from existing occupiers to dramatically upsize, double or triple in space. And clearly it's finite pitch there, so that's quite challenging, but exciting opportunity to have.
And we'll come on to that in a minute. I mean, the Sloane Street upgrade and investment is a significant investment, and it's been a significant part of your focus, I know, in recent years, and there's a lot of interest in that. More broadly, I suppose some of the things that you've been really well known for in the 14 years that you've been here are around the redevelopment of Duke of York Square, where we are today, the development along Pavilion Road. And I suppose what's been quite remarkable has been this focus on public realm, almost as an anchor tenant, not as if you were short of anchor tenants. I mean, most people would be quite happy to have one of the various LVMH brands that you've got peppered along Sloane Street. But it's almost like you've stepped back and said, well, hang on a second, there's a different way that we can go about doing this. There is a different way in which we can create a hub for people. And that was obviously a pretty smart thing to have done. And what have you found since then? I mean, we don't need to sort of dine too much out on the Pavilion Road narrative, but you know, you keep winning awards for it, and Duke of York Square, I know, is going to be expanding over the next year as well. But this concept of creating public realm and using that as an anchor for business, for footfall, has been hugely successful in Chelsea.
Well, I love that concept of public realm being an anchor. I should firstly correct the record there. I didn't develop Duke of York, although I'd love to take credit for it, but we as a business did. It predated me. Although we've focused on evolving it ever since, because I think that's one of the most important things, is to keep evolving destinations. And I love that concept of public realm being the anchor, because that's right at the heart of our holistic estate management. It's just looking at all the moving parts that make a destination successful. And public realm plays a really important part in that. But, you know, as much as anything, it's making sure the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So it's the curation of the retail, bringing in interesting domestic independents, and then having international flagships to drive footfall, for example.
And Duke of York Square, historically, it was 98, wasn't it? I think you acquired it from the MOD.
Yeah.
And it was then developed over a number of years. But now, I mean, it's a really thriving hub of F&B, some great restaurants, some nice brands. When you're thinking about the strategy for evolving the place, where do you draw the line between the local residents that obviously live here and use the place like any other high street, and those tourists that might come from the Far East or from Europe or from other parts of the UK? How do you balance that out? Because there is a bit of a conflict, isn't there, between what a local person wants and what a tourist wants.
It's interesting to say that. I don't see a conflict. The local community comes first every time, and we consult closely with them. As a consequence, it takes us longer to develop because of the engagement we go through at the beginning and throughout the process, actually. And I think the discerning international visitor is particularly attracted by the fact that this is community-centric locality, and that brings character and personality with it.
I mean, it's a good point, because I think one of the issues that many people have with UK high streets is just how samey they all look. And I think that's become very much the case when you go around many global cities now in terms of the high-end retail offering in those places. You could be in Shanghai, New York, even Mexico and Dubai and see exactly the same stores, exactly the same F&B, similar architecture, and it's all very homogenous, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's very challenging running high streets now. I think we've got a huge advantage and privilege in that we have an extensive holding here on our high streets, and that allows us to manage the whole in a holistic way, so the whole thing is attractive.
Let's just go into that a little bit, because some people might not fully understand how that works and what that means, but when people talk about Cadogan as a great estate, you own 93 acres of land in one place. What does that actually mean in terms of the day-to-day way you run the place?
I certainly think in the 21st century, I blanch at the phrase great estates. I think in this day and age, we're much more about being a family business, a long-term family business, and a business that makes decisions from which we'll benefit for the long term as well. I think we've got enlightened self-interest in that, really. We have something to gain from investing in the area long-term. That could be public realm. We're investing at the moment to replace all of the public realm on Sloane Street. We're doing that in partnership with the local authority. And that will change perceptions of Sloane Street, but not immediately. It'll take time for us to see a financial return from that.
Mm. And that's £46 million you're investing into that. It's a significant amount of money. But I think the point here is that actually, there doesn't have to be a dividing line between commercial self-interest and social good, in the sense that what's good for you financially as a business is also good socially for the community.
That's absolutely right. Otherwise, why would a business do that? You know, you have to find the motivation for that. And, you know, our prosperity and future is symbiotically linked to that of Chelsea. If Chelsea thrives, then so do we over the long term. And so that incentivizes us to invest.
And it's one of the barriers, you think, then, in terms of, I suppose, just stepping out of Chelsea for a second, one of the challenges that other high streets have faced is that the thinking is too short term. I mean, you roughly, give or take a few months, have been here as Cadogan for nearly 300 years. And not saying that everything is going to take another 300 years
not
to build.
Not me, Andrew.
But, well, not yet. I mean, you know, you've got many years left to you. I'm very confident of that. But look, the point I'm making is that you're not a closed-ended fund. So you're not sat here thinking, right, quick, we've got to get this in and out in 5 years, stabilise, let everybody repay it and out. You can take a view, and obviously you take a commercial view, but that can be a longer-term commercial view than a typical investor in real estate. And the upside for a local resident or a local business or an international business basing themselves, and you've got a lot of those, it's just a totally different feel and a different way of doing business from conventional real estate.
Yeah, absolutely right. You've sort of answered the question in a way there. I think one of the things that worries me is that when people hear long-term approach, they think complacency. And that's absolutely not what it's about. You've got to get the short-term right. So as you'd expect, we have all the financial viabilities and we're here to make money, but we're putting it in the context of a long-term as well. Mm. So you've got to get a balance between the two. Otherwise, there is a danger. Long-term decisions is just a euphemism for having got it slightly wrong and we need time to get it back.
Yeah, no, and I think there's probably a lot of fund managers right now that are extending and pretending, right? Banks as well, but that's a different podcast.
I can possibly comment on that.
But I mean, let's take Sloane Street as a good example. I mean, it's a two-year project, so it's a considerable piece of work that's going to just make the place more broader, more greener, which is going to be lovely. How do you work out the return on something like that? Because it's not quite as straightforward as if we invest £10 million in some new trees and £10 million in this or that, that it's going to generate £30 million in uplifted value. It's not quite that binary, is it?
No, I mean, estate management like this, holistic estate management, there's an element of subjectivity. In a way, it's much simpler to look at a spreadsheet, see where the dominant IRR is and follow that course, where what we're doing is balancing the two. So, of course, we ran and continue to run viabilities on that public realm, how much a rent's going to move up and how much a yield's going to move down over time for us to start to get a return. But in practice, there's an element of leap of faith, of believing in the philosophy of the approach and delivering it.
Mm. And I think that, I suppose, you know, throughout your career and with the skill set of the team that you've built, there has to be an element of conviction and gut feel and doing the right thing. And an IRR or spreadsheet is only going to tell you a certain amount of information about what you're doing. It's not going to give you a detailed overview of walkability or livability of a place. It's purely a financial instrument to tell you what the property's worth.
Yeah, you must have those IRRs there. You must have that discipline. Also, you know, if you're not taking the top performing option, which very often we're not, we need to know what it's costing us to make the decision we're taking. But there is a lot of subjectivity. It's down to the experience of individuals and their confidence, but also making sure you get input from enough people. And that's where very often the consultation engagement we do with the local community is beneficial, because we really listen to that. So you mentioned Pavilion Road a moment ago, and that's now well established and winning wonderful plaudits. But it only looks obvious now with hindsight. At the time, it didn't. It was a service road, and it was quite a big site assembly to put it together. But we went out to the local community and asked them what they wanted. And we got very clear guidance on that, which is what they wanted is a useful community shop with artisan food uses and independent businesses. And we were able to deliver that. So we're listening to a lot of voices in order to get to
the conclusion. But that's clearly not an IRR play, because I'm guessing that the local cheesemonger and the barber, you could probably resell those plots to significantly higher payers.
Yeah, there was a substantial loss in value, because the maximum value was to sell those as muse houses. But we knew what we were sacrificing in order to make that decision. And actually, the return has been far quicker and far more than I expected, because at the time, none of us anticipated the pandemic, I'm pleased to tell you. And
because lots of people got beards and the barbers are pretty busy.
Anyway, you know, it came into its own. And in working with the local authority, it accelerated the pedestrianisation, which has also underpinned the success of it. But the ripple effect on properties locally has been really quite significant. And that's where, again, where we benefit by having a large holding. So we benefit in different ways.
So it needs to be a Zoopla index on artisan cheese and what that does to
you. Yeah, it's long been known that you live near a Waitrose, it's good for property prices. It's now an artisan bakery, isn't it?
I mean, in terms of Sloane Street, one element of it that I know you're very passionate about is urban greening and generally investing in more organic street furniture. And that's going to be a challenge over the next couple of decades as climate change starts to take hold. And we've seen pockets of that over the last couple of years. How are you going about that on the estate?
Well, we've had quite a lot of success. And the measure of that is something called an urban greening factor. And we have a sustainability strategy we've called Chelsea 2030, which includes an urban greening factor target. And last year, we improved it by 12%. And incidentally, we also reduced the carbon we were using by 10%. So we were really delighted with that. And we're focusing on it, investing in it well. How we actually do it is that we improve the private gardens we're responsible for. We have 15 acres of gardens. But we don't stop there. We look at bits of land where the use is not being maximized. They may look like hardcore areas around trees. We've been able to plant them with pocket forests. We've done that in partnership with other people, Louis Vuitton, Moët Chandon. But actually, the people who benefit are local residents, because they're in residential areas.
And I think there's a level of quirkiness. It's just quite cool as well. You know, these things, I think they need to be a little bit punk, much like some of the, you know, historic fashion anchors of the King's Road. You know, these weren't anodyne corporate fashion houses, were they?
I so agree. And look, it's one of our dangers is that we over curate the area and it becomes bland. So we work hard. This is a real irony to this. We work hard at trying to make it feel organic. So if you look at Pavilion Road, it looks pretty rugged, and we encourage the retailers to do different things with chairs and tables and awnings and so on, so that it has personality and so that people can make a connection with it.
I think that's important. I mean, it is a challenge, I suppose, because, I mean, Chelsea is itself a brand, you know, in a very similar fashion to any of the fashion labels that are synonymous with it, or rock stars or whoever, right? And the success of a brand is something that everybody can feel ownership of and have their own opinion on. And there'll be lots of different people that think of Chelsea in totally different ways. And problem for you is you've got to make them all feel right.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, we've got incredible opportunity, really, because Chelsea has this amazing pedigree of being at the centre of social and cultural and artistic activity and change, really. You know, and you talk about the punks, but it goes way back to Whistler and the artists of that time. So we've got a great pedigree to draw on. We've got to make that relevant for future generations. So we attract in new generations and make it contemporary and forward-looking. And we can do that in lots of different ways. You know, one of the things we're just about to launch, in fact, is the fact we're doing a literary festival, which will be called Stories. So it encompasses the digital world as well. we're working with a partner so that we can introduce that to Chelsea again because it has such a strong literary history. But we want to make it relevant for the 21st century and beyond, Andrew.
Mm. And obviously you've got a number of cultural anchors across the area, not least Cadogan Hall, which I know the family invests or donates a significant amount of money to each year to support. And that's become a real landmark in the music community, hasn't it?
Oh, it's thriving. It's lovely to see. In fact, we own the hall and we employ a brilliant team who runs the hall for us. So it runs at a deficit and we support that deficit and the rest of the team. But it plays a really important part in the area. What I'm very interested in is the layering of uses that makes it a community so that, you know, you look at cultural uses, you might look at pubs, you look at schools, and all these things just make the area more a place people want to be before you get on to curating the retail and supporting that retail with ideally the best in class of food and drink and hospitality. But it's that layering, I think, with which we can create so much success.
And what do you think we as a society need to do to encourage more of that? Because often in areas, it will be the pubs and the music venues that are the first things to go. They'll be the first things that get flipped into flats, which makes someone a bit of dough, but doesn't necessarily do a hell of a lot for the footfall in an area or its vibrancy. And it's often these places that might not work off their own 2 feet commercially that contribute far more than the aforementioned IRR on a spreadsheet. And there is a real conflict, I feel, there between that. And we've talked about that a lot on this podcast over the years.
I agree. I think we all need to understand better what those pubs and those small shops bring, what value they bring to us that we lose if we do everything online. And clearly there's a lot of place for online transactions for commodities. But there's a lot to be said for the emotional connection people make. You know, you might be in a queue for a coffee and talk to the person next to you in the queue and it turns out they're four doors along on your street and then next time you see them, you know them slightly better. Or, you know, we were talking earlier, Andrew, you see the neighbour's teenager having a fag and you can just sort of clock him, he clocks you and stubs it out and gets on with his life. These things make a difference to people, don't they? And I think, you know, in many ways we're losing that by losing the hub of retail high streets.
Mm. And I mean, let's talk about the Gaumont, which is your flagship new development. It's £235 million development that's got an amazing 7 use classes to it. So can you talk to us? This is on the King's Road. The Gaumont's obviously a reference to the historic theatre, but it's a multi-use building that's going to be a fascinating, thriving scheme once it's fully leased up. But do you want to just talk us through how you've ended up with something with 7 use classes?
It's like three-dimensional chess, I must say. And it's taken 10 to 12 years to put together because, first of all, we had to assemble that site, which we didn't own all of it. Interesting, the pedigree, the name Gaumont comes from the Gaumont Palace Theatre, which was located there in the 30s and was a splendid and exciting destination. But it also plays tribute to Fries Green, who was the inventor of the moving image. And he was based very close to that site. And of course, what we've got there is cinema with Curzon, so we continue that pedigree. But it's a complex mixed-use scheme, which is obvious to you, because we wanted it to do so much. In principle, it's about bringing in flagship retail to balance King's Road, to bring in another anchor to balance Duke of York's, which is a great success, and to draw footfall along King's Road. And what we're aiming to do is to put in a real footfall driver there as a consequence. But at the same time, with any of our schemes, we're looking back to those IRRs we're talking about. We're looking thoroughly, you can imagine, with an investment like that and what the returns are. But then we stand back from it and say, what can it deliver for us locally? So here we've got a side street called Chelsea Manor Street, and we've managed to put in 5 or 6 small shops. We've identified them as community uses. We've just been out for a very successful local consultation, a huge response. And what we've got as a consequence is a themes emerged around creativity, around performance, things like books, things like music, creativity around art and potteries and things like that. So we're out now looking for those types of uses, which will go in on low rents, rents that are supportable by those types of businesses rather than the maximum we can achieve. But again, partly it's driven in large part really by what the local community have said they'd like to see there, but in part also because it builds the destination, it makes it more interesting, it creates another layer which people come for.
Well, it's just commercially smart, isn't it? I mean, let's be frank, let's call a spade a spade. If you've got a mixed-use scheme and you've got 47 apartments that you want to sell, and you've got retail and office space, which you have within the same building, it makes sense for the wider place just to have the best vibe possible. And I think it's often astounded me that people in this sector don't think in that way, that it's all very short-sighted often. And whilst people bang on about these things, no one really seems to, I don't know, you certainly find businesses that get it, Argent, obviously, people like Bruntwood. And I think there are a number of developers that have done some great things like that, GPE, of course. But I think there's not enough of it, because if there was more of it, we wouldn't have a lot of the issues that we have in town centres, I don't feel. Maybe I'm wrong on that point.
Well, I think there are a lot of great developers around producing a great product. But we have that benefit of owning a lot of property around here, so we can look longer term. And that's coupled with the fact that this really is a family business. The family want to be here for generations into the future.
Yeah.
And so are willing to make that bet.
Yeah.
So that helps a great deal.
Let's just concentrate on Chelsea Manor Street for a second. You're seeing that as essentially being a kind of artistic twin to Pavilion Road in a sense. So you're sort of swapping cheese for tunes.
I like that. In a sense, but it's more to do with the power of clusters, Andrew.
Yeah.
So Pavilion Road's been a success for all sorts of reasons, but partly because there's a cluster of artisan food shops there and useful shops. And they're low-value transactions, so people visit a lot and can afford to. Coffee, loaf of bread, so on. And on Chelsea Manor Street, again, looking for that creativity cluster, we're also looking more widely. So at the moment, we're marketing, getting really strong interest for the 151 Club on King's Road, which, you know, we've all known it in our past and it's hugely famous. We have a pub in that scheme, which we're busy swapping the use out now in for planning to put it into a former bank, which gives it the volume of space to have performances in there. And if we can find a pub operator who can run a theatre or have live music, then that will complement the
fact. Like the Half Moon in Putney.
Exactly like the Half Moon in Putney. Yes, not long since I've been there, actually. It's great fun. But, you know, with a nightclub, with a cinema next door, with these creative uses, perhaps a record store back there, we're bringing in a wine bar come restaurant on the roof. Again, it's nowhere near residential, so we can have a late opening. But these things together create quite a hub of activity, which can make it a really fun evening out. And again, put it in people's minds, get them to make an emotional connection. You know, we're going to Chelsea because we're going to this bit of Chelsea.
Yeah, and I think those are quite easy to measure, aren't they? Because typically, if you're going out to the cinema, I mean, I don't know what it's like during COVID, actually. We spent a lot of time walking back and forth from the Everyman in King's Cross, which was really new at the time. It was a lovely 40-minute walk home back to Highbury. We'd go out, we'd grab a pizza next door or to the Coal Office Cafe upstairs, and restaurant, spend a small fortune on cocktails. But you had a reason to go there and you'd hang around. And I think it's interesting seeing the cinema almost coming back in the age of streaming. Never seen so many boutique cinemas opening everywhere. And you've got, 600 seats?
We've got a 600-seat auditorium in there, yes, which is a big bit of kit, and Curzon are busy looking at that and getting ready to fit it out. But your
that's a lot of covers.
But your recollection there is brilliant, because that's why it's so important to put the community at the centre of things, because you may have visitors from overseas or other parts of the country visiting, but if it's right for the local community, for local residents, then it'd be right for them too.
Mm. And in terms of the office element of the scheme, what kinds of occupiers do you foresee using that space? Because obviously we're at a bit of a tipping point now in the office market, aren't we, really? There's hugely different schools of thought around working from home. You know, there's debate until not so recently about the death of the office. You obviously don't believe in the death of the office, otherwise you wouldn't be bringing substantial office space to the market. But where do you see that being positioned, given everything that we know is happening?
Look, our experience of offices in Chelsea is that people are attracted to them because of the lifestyle, because of the mixture of uses. They might not go into the shops, but they're there and they're sort of framing the character. There's restaurants and a wide variety of restaurants. And we're getting back now to what we were just talking about the cultural uses. You know, not far down the road to Cadogan Hall, there's a cinema. And what we find is that's what attracts people to our offices. So we have about 500,000 square feet of offices, and they are constantly fully let, constantly. Tend to be quite small businesses on the whole, usually private businesses, private wealth, hedge funds, private offices. And they're there because they like the environment, and they may be there because it's convenient as well. They may have a home in Southwest London, and so it's easy to get to.
Mm. I think so. The culture of businesses is often defined by where they are. And I know myself, having run and exited a couple of businesses, certainly for a large number of the years that I ran Blackstock, we were around Farringdon and Bloomsbury. We were in Hans Sloane's old house on Bloomsbury Square for a number of years. It had a blue plaque on the front of the building. I think it's probably not quite in the same state as he probably left it. But it was a beautiful property. You were nearby to everything, centre of town. And I think for any business that really puts culture at the centre of its DNA, where you're located and how you enable your staff to have fun and build morale and build relationships outside of the office environment is really key. And that's probably why walkable places like this are on the up for those sorts of occupiers. You know, it's why places like King's Cross have worked, ultimately. But for you, I know that the community is obviously a big element of how you do business. You support, to the tune of £4 million annually, a community investment fund, and you do many great things locally that you probably don't shout enough about here, if I'm honest with you. Within that canvas of social activity, what are the things that you're most passionate about? And what are the things that you'd like to do more of?
It's difficult to narrow it down, because one of the things we do in that £4 million community fund is what we call key worker housing, which is we provide flats at subsidised rentals, substantially subsidised, so they fit the salaries of people who are carrying out jobs that support the community, nurses, teachers, police officers and so on. And that's because we feel we should make an investment in those people who serve this community, living in this community. And that's really important to us. You know, we've always done this. It might have been called grace and favour a generation ago and involved vicars and bishops, but it's all part of supporting the community and having a long view. The work we do with others, clearly we support them in getting young people out of violence and gangs, I think is particularly moving. And through the local community foundation, the Kensington and Chelsea Foundation, where we support their operational costs, we also it's sort of an investment in the SOS St. Giles initiative, which is about mentoring young people out of gangs and out of violence and showing them a route to a safer future. One listens to some of the case studies, it's really moving stuff and it feels very worthwhile. So as a business, clearly community is right at the centre of things. We've talked about that, and that's long-term self-interest. But also these sorts of investments in longer-term health of the community is in our interest. So it gives us a very strong purpose to what we do. And that's more and more important, isn't it?
Mm. And this desire to support the community is very much how Lord Cadogan, who sadly passed away last year, was remembered and is remembered as someone that personally was absolutely passionate about doing all of these things. And it's great to see that's obviously clearly a huge part of the DNA of the organisation.
That's absolutely right. I mean, it was very genuinely where he saw his role as helping people who had made a contribution locally, but perhaps they'd hit on hard times or they needed some help. And he did that very privately, very discreetly, through the family charity, which donates in excess of $2.5 million a year to local causes. And now his son, Edward, who's now the Earl, is carrying on in that family tradition. And it's important to us. It supports the business and supports the philosophy.
And how have you dealt with that transition? Obviously, it's a challenging time when someone you've been very close to passes away. But how has that transition been for you personally?
Well, the transition for the business has been very smooth, because the late Lord Cadogan passed over to his son 12 years ago. And so Edward has been non-executive chair of the business for some time and is very comfortable and proficient and able in the role. Personally, I knew his father pretty well and spoke to him regularly each week. And he was a great character, a man of a different age, but a very colourful character. And I kind of miss him, actually. He was different, and that's quite a buzz, really.
And in terms of your career, you've been in, I can't use the phrase great estates if you don't like it, but I'm going to use it.
Whatever phrase you like, Andrew, you always do.
It's not a phrase I like. It's a phrase that people will use. And unfortunately, it's a slightly suboptimal way to differentiate family-run, I can just say family-run property companies, but I think there's a certain breed of family-run property company that you are versus others. But before Cadogan, you were with the Portman Estate, and before that, the Richard Ellis part of CBRE, for people that remember that. What has been some of the defining milestones in your career? What have been some of the things that have really driven you, inspired you, and made you a success?
That's very generous indeed. Look, I mean, I just feel that Great Estates is a bit grand, so I'm just going to reply to you on that.
No, it's fine. Because I'm obviously joshing with you.
I know you are. You always do. But, you know, in the 21st century, we're much more about service delivery. Customer service is really important to us. Working in partnership with our occupiers is vital to our success. And I've already talked about how close we want to engage with
community. I'm going to cut across you. And if anybody doubts that, come down here on a Saturday afternoon.
So that's why I rile at the Great Estates dementia. But in terms of my experience, I had great good fortune in stumbling into Portman because I didn't know anything about it at the time. And I wrestled with myself as to whether to leave Richard Ellis, which I loved, and I still have great friends from those days. And eventually, as you know, decided to go to Portman. And I thought I had skills and experience that matched the role, but I was learning on the job and I was very lucky to do so. Because I learned a huge amount at Portman. And that translated well when I moved to Cadogan. You know, Portman is a collection of really impressive private family trusts in private portfolios, whereas Cadogan's much more of a unified property company. And so that translated well. I learned an immense amount early in my career because after going backpacking in Africa, I ended up working there. And there, you've got to be very resourceful there because there's nobody else to fall back on. So I was in Cape Town in South Africa, I was in Kenya, and I was in Botswana, and almost Namibia. But that's when I decided it was time to return.
Oh, wow. And what are some of the best pieces of advice that you've taken and ignored? One or two taken, one or two ignored that you wish you'd taken?
The worst bit of advice I can remember is better to stay silent and be thought a fool than to speak up and be known as one, which is rubbish. You should speak up at all times, but it stuck in my mind. Best bit of advice was my wonderful guy, Ian Grant, the Scotsman, who was my boss in Botswana, who used to say, I can't do the accent, Andrew, so I'm not even going to try, but you can't catch a plane unless you buy a ticket. My sons are pig sick of me saying that to them, but you know, it's grasping opportunities is really it.
That's interesting. So you've got three sons?
Three sons.
That must be an interesting Christmas.
Great fun.
Are you shepherding them into the real estate universe, or are they...
No, absolutely not. If I tried to shepherd them in any direction, they'd move with equal and opposite force in the opposite direction. So that's the thing with children, isn't it? So computer science has been one of them, a lifelong ambition, and so he's doing really well at that. Second one's studying psychology at Leicester, and he's enjoying it immensely. And the third one's still at school, but looks and sounds like an engineer to me. So far, no real estate, but who knows what will happen there.
Well, that's good. At least when the robots take over, you'll have skin in the game with fixing them and understanding their problems. So that's a good thing. I mean, one thing just to cover before we close, this is a good example of an issue which the industry has, which they've tried speaking up on, but not necessarily cut through on, is around leasehold reform, which I know is something that you have some views on. I mean, is it worth just explaining in plain English to people what the government's proposing to do and why it potentially creates some unintended consequences for owners of real estate?
Well, there's three things there. I mean, there's a whole plethora of proposals they're making, which more or less I support because it takes the complexity out of legislation, and it is very complex legislation. But there's three things that they're doing which we're working hard to point out to them the unintended consequences of. One is changing the proportion of residential space in a building which permits the occupiers of that residential space to buy the freehold, enfranchise the freehold. And the proposal is to change that from 50% to 75%. And that will have the unintended consequence of meaning that a lot of high streets where there's a shop with two flats above it, they'll be able to be enfranchised, so the freehold will change hands. Mm. And that'll make it much more difficult to manage those high streets dynamically because you'll go through a resident management group that may not be motivated or resourced to respond. So you want approval to put in a new retailer, you want approval to change the signage, the shop fit and so on. It will be difficult to get and something I'm sure those residents won't wish to do. So I think that's damaging to high streets across the country. I think it's a deterrent to mixed-use schemes like King's Cross, like the scheme we've just done at the Gaumont, which has 47 flats in it, because you have a risk of losing the ability to manage those schemes. So I think it'll be a greater encouragement to reduce the amount of residential in them. Mm. The other two are valuation linked, and they're simply about the transfer of wealth. So government said that he wants to abolish marriage value, which is part of the valuation, and also to retrospectively remove ground rents. Now, if those two things happen, it'll effectively transfer wealth from the freeholder to the leaseholder. It won't change the leasehold system one bit. It'll be a one-off transfer of wealth that won't feed into the system because the recipient of that wealth won't reduce the value in future. They'll take the full value of the freehold they've now got when they sell. And I don't really think that that's fully understood. Now, the research we've done shows that, and you'd expect instinctively, that most of the marriage value by value is in the high-value homes, and they're in central London. They're in Camden, Westminster, and Kensington and Chelsea. And something like two-thirds of the value are in those three boroughs. So it's not about levelling up. This is a transference of wealth to already pretty wealthy homeowners in central London. And then if you add to that the fact that over 50% of those property owners are investors, and many of them overseas, then it's really quite hard to understand the rationale behind it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the challenges we have is it's just a packed legislative agenda and things being rushed through without the requisite amount of thinking. And I think this particular topic has been driven by the consumer side of people buying houses, far cheaper houses than the ones that you sell around here, but relatively cheap houses on terrible leasehold agreements that have screwed over consumers. And this is a typical sledgehammer to crack a nut response that we often see, not looking at some of the nuance and complexity, because it's a bloody complex topic.
It is. But I mean, these proposals don't fix that problem, and the people who are abusing the system have long gone. So
there needs to be a bit of a stop and a pause, which we can only hope occurs in the next few months. Well, look, let's end it on a positive note. Let's not end it there. What are the two or three things you're most looking forward to over the next year? I mean, there's a lot of people in the market are quite gloomy at the minute, but you're very upbeat for all of the right reasons. There's a lot of really amazing stuff happening over the course of this year, not least with the Gaumont coming to the market and the other regeneration plans. But personally and professionally, what are some of the things that you're most excited by?
Seeing the Gaumont let up, and of course there'll be some big returns from the big shops, but I'm particularly excited about seeing us let up that pub with the performance space in it, because I think the type of occupier and the character of that will have a big impact. So those things I'm really looking forward to and very excited about.
Amazing. And obviously all of these podcasts, we do them in collaboration with Property Week, so there'll be an article online and we'll make sure that some of the imagery for the Gaumont is in that for anyone that's interested to have a look at. But look, it's been a fascinating conversation, Hugh Seaborne. Thank you so much for coming in and being so honest and upfront about everything. It's really refreshing. And I was at a lunch the other day with a couple of your residents. They mentioned in the conversation they lived in Chelsea. And I was just, you're getting a little bit of colour really just to inform this conversation. And they really echoed what a lot of people in the market say, which is that in a very quiet, discreet and humble fashion, Cadogan has just been very, very progressive over the last 10 years, and a lot has happened without much fanfare that you'd normally get with so many property companies, and it's just really overhauled the place for the better. And I think I'd echo that myself, despite being a North Londoner. They're kind of getting better at letting me into West London these days. But I think many people will be very proud of what you've done and wish you all the best of luck with what's still to come on the journey. So thank you very much, Hugh Seaborne, boss of Cadogan. This has been PropCast. I've been Andrew Teacher as ever, and you can subscribe, listen, download, comment and share via Apple, Spotify, Amazon, SoundCloud, and wherever you get your podcasts from. And propertyweek.com will have a nicely written up feature alongside this piece. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again very, very soon.